Let us turn again this morning to continue with our ongoing studies in Paul's letter to the Romans. We began this study a number of months ago now in chapter 12, where we see that in that chapter 12 the apostle begins to apply in practical ways the doctrines of the Christian faith. We find this as a principle of the way that the Bible presents its message to us. It gives us, first of all, the indicatives, and then it gives us the imperatives, telling us what God has done for us, and then telling us what we now must do for God in response to what God has done for us. And we find this in the Old Testament as well as in the New. The people of God were to live as God's people because God had taken them to be his own. He had taken them out of the land of Israel, out of the house of bondage. He was their God, and now they were to live as those who had been redeemed by grace and consecrated to the God who had redeemed them. And this is what we find right throughout the Bible. The prophets preached this. The psalmists wrote and sang about it. I love the Lord because he has heard my voice and my supplication. It's always the same principle. We are to repent because the kingdom of God has come near. The kingdom of God has drawn near. God has taken the initiative, and we are to respond to it by repenting and coming into it. This is the pattern that we find right throughout the Bible. The Christian life, as we have seen, is really nothing more than a response to God's mercy. We believe it, we respond in faith and hope and love, because he first of all has loved us. That is what the Christian life is all about. It is responding to God because of his grace and mercy. And this is what the Christian life is according to the apostle, as we have been seeing in Romans chapter 12 and into chapter 13. We have seen how the appeal that the apostle makes to us as Christians, to live as Christians, is, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God. It is because of God's mercies that we are to live as we are commanded to do. Well, we've looked at some of the details of this Christian life in chapter 12, the issue of relationships, basically. Our relationship to God, our relationship to our fellow believers, how are we to respond one to another? Our relationship to the world at large. And we began last time in chapter 13, verses 1 to 7, to look at Paul's teaching concerning our relationship to the civil magistrate. And we come back again to these verses in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 to 7, because we're not finished with them yet, and we're going to come back to them yet again on another occasion. We began to consider these verses last time, and we made some general introductory comments in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 to 7, concerning the civil magistrate. And we spoke in general terms about how we are to respond to the powers that be, as Paul calls it. It's important for us to remember, to keep firmly in mind, that this passage of Scripture is not a political theorist tract. It is a passage that has to do with the Christian life. Paul's not talking about political theories. He's talking about Christians living in the state. And it's important for us to keep in mind, because as I mentioned to you last Sunday morning, the Apostle Paul tells us that, or one of the commentators rather, tells us that Paul is giving to us here probably the finest piece of political theory that has ever been written. And yet the same commentator makes the point that there is probably no political person or party has ever taken its politics from the teaching of St. Paul. And that is probably true. And Paul was under no delusions. He knows very well the kind of powers that be that we find in the world. But nonetheless, how are we as Christians to respond to them? That is the issue. Well, let's remind ourselves of what these verses have to say. Romans chapter 13 from verse 1 to 7. Paul says, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers," or the superior authorities, literally. "For there is no authority but of God. The authorities that are," he says, "are ordained, they are appointed, they are instituted, they are emplaced by God. Whosoever resists the authority resists the ordinance or the appointment of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves judgment," condemnatory judgment. "For rulers," he says, "are not a terror to good works, but to the evil workers. Will you then not be afraid of the authority," that is of the civil magistrate, "do that which is good, and you shall have praise of the same." You will have his approval. "For he is the minister of God to you for good. But if you do that which is evil," Paul says, "you better be afraid, because he does not bear the sword in vain," that is, with an empty gesture. "For he is the minister of God, a revenger," or an avenger, "to execute wrath upon him that does evil. Wherefore you must needs be subject not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake," for conscience towards God. For this cause you pay tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor." And our interest in these words this morning is, hopefully, as Christians, and hopefully we want to learn about our response to the civil magistrate, because tragically Christians very often do not respond in the way that Paul is exhorting. At least very often they do not respond willingly in the way that Paul is evidently intending. When he says in the opening statement, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers," what he means is be subject willingly, not reluctantly, not being forced to do this, but to do it as an act of obedience to God. When we serve the civil magistrate, Paul says we are serving God. We serve not only because we're afraid of wrath, but we do it for conscience' sake, he says, seeking always to have a good conscience before God and before men. And so the Apostle Paul is exhorting us as Christians to do what he is telling us to do, submit and pay our taxes with a willing heart, because we're actually giving to God's ordinance. And to withhold obedience and to withhold our taxes is to be withholding from God. This is an act of worship that Paul has in mind. It is an act of devotion. And according as we understand that the nature of the civil magistrate, that is political government, is from God, we will do so willingly, recognizing that we are not just giving to men, we're not giving to a political party, we are giving to God's ordinance for us, for our good in the world. Now, what we're wanting to do this morning is to look more particularly at this authority of the civil magistrate that Paul has in mind. And then, God willing, next time we're going to come back and look at these verses again and look more closely at the response that the Bible is teaching that we as Christians ought to make. And this morning we're going to look at this whole question, or not the whole question, because we can't deal with all of this, of course. We're just going to make passing comments, really. This question of there is no power, but the powers that be are ordained of God. What does Paul mean? What is he talking about when he says that the civil magistrate is appointed by God? And then we're going to look at what Paul tells us here about these civil magistrates, about as being rulers. He calls them rulers, but he also calls them servants, or ministers, or servants. And we're going to look, thirdly, at this issue of what Paul calls here the sword. He does not bear the sword in vain. And then finally, this morning, we shall close off by making some comments on the Christian's responsiveness to all of these things. And next time, we're going to look at the Christian's response in greater detail, the response of submission, the response of support of the civil magistrate paying our taxes. What does that mean? And then, of course, the Bible tells us that we're to pray for those in authority. It was interesting that at our recent synod, one of the ministers who has recently come into the denomination, he was making the point that the denomination that he has come from to come into our denomination, in the previous denomination, he says it was a matter of principle that they prayed for the civil magistrate. And he noted that in our denomination there is not a great deal of emphasis upon giving due respect and prayers and petition on behalf of the Queen and the civil magistrates. There are some denominations, as you well know, where they place a great deal of emphasis upon this, and they are quite right to do so, because the Bible makes it very clear that this is part of our duty to the civil magistrate. And I think it is true to say that in our denomination, generally speaking, we do not give sufficient place to this most important teaching that we find in the Word of God. And then we're going to find not only that we're to pray for the civil magistrate, but we're also to testify to the civil magistrate. We do the civil magistrate an act of homage and an act of duty when we tell the civil magistrate what God's purpose for him and for the world is. And we find many examples of that in the Bible, as well as in the history of the church. So that's the kind of thing that we're going to be looking at over the next considerations of this great passage. But all the time we must remember that we are being exhorted here as Christians. This is our duty. This is not something that we can add to our Christian life, to the great doctrine of justification by faith and sanctification and glory. This is part of what it means to be a Christian, to recognize where we stand in relationship to those who are the higher authorities, as Paul tells us. Well, first of all, then, this morning, what does the Apostle Paul mean when he says here that the powers that be are ordained of God? He tells us that in verse 1 and 2. There is no power, he says, but that which is ordained of God. And whoever resists or rejects the power is in fact resisting something that God has instituted. Now, this word ordained, that is translated as ordained, is a word in the Greek language which means to put in order or to put in its proper place. It's a word that has to do with taking something and placing it in its proper position. It's a word that has to do with military hierarchies, where the commanders in the army, they will promote certain individuals into a certain position. And they will, as it were, give them the king's commission. And because that individual is placed in that position, whether he be a non-commissioned officer or a commissioned officer, whatever rank, that man has an appropriate authority. And he has a wide range of rights. He has a place in which he is entitled to give commands and to issue orders and to make rules within the limitations of his own domain. Now, this is the idea that the Apostle Paul is speaking about when he says the powers that be, the governments of the world, are ordained of God. And as we mentioned last week, we just mentioned in passing, Paul is not speaking about here about any theoretical government. He's not saying the ideal government is appointed by God. He specifically says the powers that be are appointed by God. And the language that Paul uses literally is the powers existing now. And Paul knew that there were many different kinds of governments in the world, and some of them were very wicked governments. And indeed, the church at Rome was under the Roman rule, which was a heathen government. And as we mentioned last time, the emperor who was on the throne of Rome, when Paul actually wrote this epistle to the Romans, was in fact Nero. He was already 3 years into his reign, Nero. He was already showing signs of that megalomania that in about 10 or 11 years' time was going to actually destroy him, cause him to commit suicide and create such havoc among the Christians and indeed among the citizenry of Rome, because we know that it was during this madman's reign that Rome was burnt. And as they say, that Nero was fiddling and rejoicing and laughing at the spectacle while Rome was burning and people were being burnt out of their house and home. And already the megalomania era is beginning to show signs of that wickedness that was going to reach such magnitudes and proportions. And yet Paul is writing to the very church in Rome, which was living, as it were, next door to Nero's household. And Paul is saying that the government, even Nero's government, is the appointment by God. It is in God's purpose and it is God's providence that a monster like Nero should actually occupy the supreme place in the Roman government at the very time when Paul was writing these words. So Paul was not speaking about any theoretical perfect government. He is speaking about the awful governments who actually exist. And the history of the world is a history where very often we see that the supreme criminals in any land happen to be included amongst those higher authorities. But that does not negate what the Apostle Paul is teaching when he says that the powers that be are ordained of God. It has always been God's purpose, and in God's providence as he works out history, it is the fact of the matter that governments do and always have existed. And when the Apostle Paul is speaking of the power exercising the sword of authority, for example, he is not saying for one moment that it is because of human sinfulness that we need governments. He is saying it is a matter of the way that human people must live in the world that we need governments. It's not because we are sinners that we need higher authorities to rule over us. It is because we are social creatures that we need higher authorities to rule over us. You remember what was said away back in Genesis chapter 2 at the very beginning, when the Lord God had just created man. And according to the teaching of the Bible, there was only one man. There was no woman at that time, according to the teaching of Genesis. And you remember what God said about man. It is not good for man to live alone. And then, of course, you remember the narrative of the creation of the woman for the man, and how delighted the man and the woman were in each other's company. But that great principle, you know, it is not good for a man to live alone, doesn't just mean that a man needs a woman or a woman needs a man to fulfill their nature in its full complementary sense. It means that we need each other. It means that we are social creatures. We are made for society. We are made not just for, as it were, a man for a woman and a woman for a man, but we are made in order to live in families and in communities and indeed in tribal groups, if you like, that ultimately become the nations of the world. And it has always been God's intention that in these societies there must inevitably be some kind of organization. There must be a hierarchy of rules. There have to be those who will say what the rules are going to be at any given moment in time. And it is not necessarily the people who are in higher authority that Paul has in mind. It is the principle of higher authority. It is the idea of government itself. Now, many governments, and perhaps all governments, have fallen short of the ideal. And Paul is recognizing that, and we have to recognize that. But the fact of the matter is, we are recognizing not the person who is in the office, but the office that the individual person holds. It is the office of the higher authority that is to be submitted to, in the same way as in the military hierarchy. You may have a man put into office, he may be promoted to be a captain in the army or some such thing. Now, the man individually may be a crook, he may be an immoral man, he may be not the best person to admire in the world, he may be someone whom the men under him hold in a measure of contempt. But yet, when they meet that man, they will salute the man, not because they respect the man, but because he wears the badges of authority. He wears the stars of a captain on his shoulders. They are respecting and they are saluting the authority invested in the man. And this is primarily what Paul has in mind whatever we may think of politicians personally, is not the issue. We may like them, we may admire them, we may think they're bad or good or whatever. That's not the issue. The issue is the investiture of the authority that we are to recognize in them. Whatever they may be personally, they are authoritatively the higher authority. And this is the idea that Paul has in mind. And the Bible makes this very clear right throughout many places in the Old Testament. We have the teaching that God raises some up, he raises others down, he casts others down. In our studies in Habakkuk in the evening, for example, we have seen how the Lord was going to raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation. And yet they were going to be his appointed authority to come and invade Judah and discipline his people for their good ultimately. And you remember how, again in the book of Daniel, how Nebuchadnezzar was forced in chapter 4 in the book of Daniel to recognize that there was a God in heaven, and he ruled over the armies of heaven and amongst the inhabitants of the earth. And he was doing whatever he pleased, and there was nobody could say unto him, what doest thou? He sets up kings, and he brings kings down. And in the prophecies of the scriptures, when we find these empires, the great four empires of the Old Testament, again mentioned in the book of Daniel, these empires don't just emerge because men think that this would be the best way to go. These things are being spoken of in prophecy because God is saying this is how he is going to accomplish his purposes in the world. And we have got to come to terms with the fact that God reigns, but he reigns through means and he reigns through men. And this is what the Apostle Paul is speaking about. Now, he tells us here that these are appointed by God, as we're going to see, for our good. The providence of God is such that all things ultimately do work together for good to those who love God. And the civil magistrate, whatever his crimes may be, nonetheless is in authority, and he does a measure of good, as we're going to see. Even Mussolini caused the trains in Rome to run on time. And even Hitler, for all his monstrous megalomania, put 8 million Germans back to work in the early 1930s. 8 million unemployed. He gave them jobs building autobahns, building Volkswagens, and he gave them jobs and he gave them social security. And in all his wickedness, there was in that sense a measure of good. And it is God's providence that we have civil government, because the wrath of man, if there is no civil government, the only alternative is absolute anarchy. And because of human nature, and each man will prefer to do that which is right in his own eyes, there has to be in any society some rule of law, law and order. And this is what the Apostle Paul is speaking about in general terms. And God has appointed these things, not only for his own glory, but for our good. You and I, we may agree or we may disagree with the government of Australia. And I'm sure we all have strong convictions concerning what they do or don't do at the present time. But the fact of the matter is that you and I can worship here without fear of interruption or persecution. And we can worship here in the knowledge that there are police cars patrolling our streets. And when we go to bed at night, we are in a measure secure in our persons and in our property, because there is a civil magistrate and he does not bear the sword in vain. And you and I can worship here because we are permitted by the laws of this land so to gather as Christians. And I can stand up in this pulpit of free speech and preach the gospel according as we find it in the Bible. There are places in the world where we could not so gather. There are places in the world where I would be instantly taken off to prison for saying some of the things that I say from this pulpit. But in our land at the present time, the appointment of God's magistrates is that we are allowed the freedom of speech, the freedom of worship, And we are to regard this as a great boon and a benefit given to us not just by the lawmakers of the land, but by the God who has appointed authority in high places for the good of his people, for the good of man generally, for family life, for trade and so on. And all of that's included. That's just a general comment about what Paul means. The powers that be, they are ordained of God. And from the very beginning of time, there has been this higher authority. And Charles Hodge is quite right in his commentary when he makes the point that this principle does not just mean the kings and the emperors and the governments of the day, but it extends to all authority, all lawful authority, the authority of parents over their children, the authority of schoolmasters in the school, the authority of captains of industry, the authority wherever there is lawful authority, whatever kind it is, of whatever level it be, whether it be local councils making rules and regulations for the collection of the garbage or the parking meters. Whatever it be, the authority is lawful insofar as the magistrate indeed legislates within terms of the general terms of the moral law of God. It is lawful authority that is to be respected and obeyed and indeed supported. And this is basically what Paul is saying. There are no exceptions. There are no ifs and buts about this. And Christian people must recognize that the powers that be are God's gift to us in order that life will be tolerable, orderly, worship will be allowed, and we can go about our business as free men with the protections of the sword of the magistrate. This is what Paul is saying. And this is something that is very often forgotten. And we must not be among those anarchists like the man who wanders up on the beach in some place, he meets some of the locals and he says, is there a government here? Yes, well, I'm against it. We must not be just automatically against the government of whatever kind. Because when we read the scriptures of the Old Testament, we find that Daniel and his companions were most respectful to the king of Babylon or kings of Babylon, whether it be Nebuchadnezzar or later on Darius, or even Belshazzar later on, because Daniel was respectful in his speech to Belshazzar. Or whether it be the Apostle Paul, when he was arrested in Jerusalem and carried off to Rome as a prisoner, he was most respectful to those who were in authority over him. And he is thereby setting us an example, because Paul understood, you see, something of God's mysterious providence of ordering civil magistrates for our good. So that's the first thing generally. But notice how Paul here speaks of the civil magistrate, particularly is in terms of a ruler. For rulers, he says, are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. The word here for rulers is just the ordinary work for those who have the function of ruling. They are the archons, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the authority of the ruler, he says, do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same, for he is the minister of God to thee for good. Now, there are two things that Paul is emphasizing here, particularly about those who are occupying the higher authorities. He says, first of all, they are a ruler, and then he says also that they are a minister. So he is saying that they are rulers, but they are not absolute rulers. There are certain limitations to the rulers that they also are obliged to observe. When he says here, rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil, he is the minister of God to thee for good, Paul is reminding us of something that is very important when we think of God's purpose in ordaining or appointing the powers that be. And that is that they are not meant, they were never intended to rule in their own interest and for their own selfish self-aggrandizement. The rulers that God has appointed, or the idea of government that God has appointed, is to you, the ruled, and for your good. Now, we know, and probably it is true to say that there probably has never been, or at least I've never heard of, any government ever in history, not even the governments in Israel in ancient times, which were absolutely committed to the goodness of those over whom they were ruling. There is often a selfishness. There is a party political mentality comes in, where you serve the party, you do whatever is right. Whatever it takes is the title of a book that a famous politician in Australia wrote. You do whatever it takes. Whatever crookedness, whatever wily working is involved, you do what it takes to support the party. Now that is a violation of this great principle that Paul is speaking about here as to the ideal purpose of the civil magistrate. But it is true to say that human nature, being what it is in its selfish sinfulness, nonetheless, power corrupts and absolute power does tend to corrupt absolutely. And even in Israel of old, even King David, if you look at the life of King David, and I don't want to be continually harping on about criticizing King David, but if we look at the life of David, the sweet psalmist of Israel, the man after God's own heart, the sweet poet whose poems we have so many of them in the Psalms, when we look at the life of David, we will see that there were occasions when David was not only a sensual, sinful man, he was a selfish man. David liked power. David wielded power. There were times when he had an interest in God's people. There were other times when he seems not to have had. There are times when David used his power for his own ends, for his own sinful ends, for his own sensual indulgence, and for his own, material prosperity and security. Even King David was not absolutely a ruler always for the good. He was what we might call a benign ruler. And his monarchy was different to every other kind of monarchy that you would find in the ancient Near East at the time. And when Nathan the prophet, you remember, went in to speak to King David about his terrible sin of adultery and murder, do you remember how Nathan spoke to David? "You are the man," he says. Now, there was no prophet in Babylon would ever go into a Babylonian and king, "You are guilty of murder and adultery." There was no Assyrian prophet would ever go to a king of Assyria and say, "You are guilty of adultery and murder." The Babylonians and the Assyrians tell us what they would have done to such a man. They would have skinned him alive and cut off his nose. You didn't speak to these monarchs in that way, but in Israel you could. Because in these other nations, you see, the people were ruled not by the rule of law, but by rulers. But in Israel, even King David was under the rule of law. He was under the law, the moral law of God, the Ten Commandments. And David recognized and respected and submitted to the ultimate authority of God's law over him. And that is why David was afraid. And Nathan had to reassure him, "You will not die." He deserved to die. The law of Moses said that for adultery and murder, the penalty was death. And both David and Bathsheba would have and could have been put to death. But they were not, because God had other purposes for them. But the point is, you see, that David recognized the limitations. And he recognized that he, for all his grand position as monarch in the kingdom of Israel, nonetheless, he too was under a higher law. And Nathan, the prophet, spoke to him of that higher law. And David acknowledged his sin and his guilt and submitted to the teaching and the rebukes of the prophet. I'm emphasizing that because, you see, rulers were never intended to rule for themselves. They were meant to be rulers for good. And even Nero and the Roman Empire, for all its cruelty and heathenism, nonetheless, it wasn't so totally committed to evil and malignancy that there was no good come out of it. The Roman Empire, for all its crimes, instituted some very good things. There was the famous Pax Romana, you might remember. You might know of the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome, Wherever the flag or the eagles of Rome were, there was a measure of law and order instituted. The Roman legions were there to ensure that Roman law was obeyed. There were roads that were built. There were aqueducts. There was sometimes flush toileting. There were all kinds of rules and regulations. There was order brought into the chaos of the warring tribes in Gaul and in what became known as Germany, the Teutonic tribes. And in different places, Roman law wasn't always just creating destruction. It was an orderly rule. And Babylon, even the great Nebuchadnezzar, the great warrior, spent most of his 40-year reign as a builder. And so when we are told here that the civil magistrate is the minister of God to thee for good, every government, however wicked it may be in its personnel and its politics, some goodness comes out of it. And I'm not trying to, as it were, ease the burden of some of the cruelest tyrannies that this world has ever known, such as Hitler and Stalin and these men and other monsters like them. But Russia was dragged, after all, during the 30s and into the 40s, kicking and screaming into the modern world in the five-year plans that Stalin did institute. And today Russia is enjoying a great deal of the benefits of modern living that actually were laid in foundation during the Iron Man Stalin's reign. I'm simply giving these as examples of how in the midst of wicked and selfish living for those in high places, nonetheless there is law and order. And we cannot live without law and order. And Charles Hodge is quite right when he points out that under even the most tyrannical of rulers, family life is possible. Family life is protected. The laws and the rules may well be different, how family life is to be conducted, and how weddings are to take place, and all these kinds of things. But nonetheless, family life is recognized and admired in every culture. Even Nero, for all his incestuous relationships, recognized that family life was a good thing. And down through the ages, it has always been the same. And trade, prosperity. If you don't want to go to war with your neighbors, what do you do with them? You trade with them. You never go to war with people that you're trading with. The politicians know that. And as Churchill puts it in his own inimitable way, yaw, yaw, he says, is always better than war, war. Go and talk about it instead of shooting about it. To talk about it is always better than going to war over it. And so this is the great principle that Paul has in mind. The institution of government and the rulers are ministers of God, ultimately for God and for the good of the people. And this means, among other things, that the powers that be are going to be answerable to God for how they have lived as the powers that be. You see, the Bible teaches us that we are all going to give an account to ourselves of ourselves before God. Each one gives an account. And we're all going to give a different kind of account, not only because we're all different, but because we all have different roles in life to play. Those who are in power, the Prime Minister of Australia is going to have to give an account to God as a man, as a sinful man. He is going to have to give an account as a father of a family. How did you deal with your family? He has to give an account as a husband of a wife. How did you treat your wife? But as well as giving an account for these private and familial relationships, he also has to give an account as the supreme executive officer of a country. How did you rule Australia? Did you rule it for good and for God? Or did you rule it in the interests of party politics and selfish ambition and material gain? You see, at the end of the day, if it is true that the powers that be are ordained and appointed by God, then ultimately they, each one in their persons and in their relationships as the authorities in this world, they are to give an account to God, not only for their private conduct, but for their public policies. Nero is God's appointment for Rome in that day and in that generation. But he has to give an account. How did you live, Nero? How did you use your imperial power? How did you use the authority that I invested you in? What did you do with the position that you were so privileged by me to occupy? Did you use it to persecute Christians? Did you use it to commit disgraceful sexual immoralities and indecencies? Or did you do it as my minister for good? See, that's the issue. And if it is true that these powers that be have great authority, they also have great responsibility. And quite frankly, I would not like to be standing in any of their shoes. I've got enough to answer for without having to answer for the destiny of a whole people. And so there are tremendous issues here, you see. The powers that be are intended, and to a certain degree they all do fulfill the mandate of being rulers for good and rulers who are the ministers of God. And if you and I would have their approval and not their anger unleashed against us, we are reminded by Paul in verse 3, "For rulers are not a terror to the good works, but to the evil. If you don't want to be afraid of the police knocking at your door, then keep the law and you'll not have them chasing after you. Will you then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good and thou shalt have praise." You will have his approval. And then Paul mentions also not only the fact that these rulers are appointed by God and that they are rulers intended to implement rule for good as under God, and their rules that they implement are only lawful insofar as they are within the permissible limits of the moral law. We saw last Sunday morning, you remember, that there are limitations to subjecting ourselves to the civil magistrate. When the civil magistrate's laws and God's laws clash, then we always obey God rather than men. We find that in the Bible. We gave examples of it last Sunday in Daniel chapter 3, Daniel chapter 6. The apostles in Acts chapters 4 and 5, you remember, said to the higher authorities, "We always choose to obey God rather than men." And when the civil magistrate rules that we do something that God forbids, we don't obey him. We obey God. If the civil magistrates that Christianity is to be proscribed, no public gatherings of Christianity, no gatherings of Christianity, we obey God when he says, "Do not forsake the assembling of yourselves together." We obey God. And when the civil magistrates that you will fall down and worship my golden image, we, like the three young children in Daniel chapter 3, we remain standing. We do not bow down to the gods of gold or the gods of Babylon. We obey God rather than men. And so this is how we're to understand the limitations of the civil magistrate's lawful authority. If a government legislates for something that is contrary to the moral law, it is, as far as Christians and as far as God is concerned, it is illegal legislation and it is not to be obeyed. It's as simple as that. And it is as difficult as that. But the third thing this morning is this. I'm going to have to press on. The sword of the magistrate. For he is the minister of God to thee for good, but if you do that which is evil, you better be afraid, because he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, an avenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. This bearing of the sword of the magistrate, what is this sword? Well, the sword, of course, is the symbol of authority, but it's the symbol of a particular kind of authority. The sword is a symbol of violence. It's a symbol of force. It's the use of force. The civil magistrate, under certain circumstances, is entitled to be violent. He is entitled to use force to fulfill his mandates and to punish those who would disobey his lawful rules. This is what Paul is saying. And he does not bear the sword in vain. One of the commentators, I think it was Brunner, Emil Brunner, I think it is, in one of his places, he makes the point that as far as we know, there has never been a state, a nation in the whole history of the world that has been able to dispense with the sword. Whether it be the primitive sword of stones or axes or the more modern sword of high velocity machine guns or whatever, the sword has always been, as John Murray puts it in his commentary on Romans, part of the chief equipment of the magistrate. The chief equipment is the sword. He comes with the sword. And that may well be military forces. It may be armed police forces. But it represents some organized violence on behalf of the state. And Paul is saying that this civil magistrate has that right given to him by God to inflict violence on those who would do evil within their jurisdiction. Now, this is a solemn and a most searching statement, because what Paul is saying here, there are certain times when crimes can be of so violent and so heinous a nature that the civil magistrate responds in kind. There are those, you know, who object to the death penalty on the basis that they say it is no better than murder. It is simply state-sanctioned murder. Well, I hope that nobody here this morning has that foolish notion in their head whatsoever. And if you do, then the sooner you get rid of that idea, the better. The imposition of a capital punishment for a capital offense is not murder. It is judicial penalty. It is the official execution of the sword. And this is what Paul is saying. And this raises the question, does it not, of going to war? Does the civil magistrate have the right, on certain circumstances, to go to war in that violent, organized, destructive campaign that is war? What is war? It is organized violence at the national level. It is organized cruelty. And yet it seems that from what Paul is saying, there are times when the civil magistrate has a right to declare that war, in the knowledge that there is going to be violence and force and destruction as an inevitable consequence. Now, these are very solemn issues. We're not going to go into all of that this morning, because that's not our concern, really. But it does raise the whole issue of law and order. What is the purpose of the criminal jurisdiction and the infliction of criminal sentences upon those who have been convicted of criminal offences? There are different views. The jurists have different views on this, as you can well imagine. There are those who say that the purpose, really, of imprisonment, for example, or even imposing a fine or some other sentence, is to reform the criminal. In other words, the interest of the criminal is paramount. He must, through our system, become a reformed, good citizen of society. Now, he may or he may not go through the system and become reformed. Some are reformed, some are not. But that's not the point. That's not even the purpose of it. The purpose of the wielding of the sword is not to reform criminals. There's far too much talk of the rights of criminals and not enough of the rights of the offended against and the victims of the criminals. But that's another story as well. Is it then to deter? There are those who say we shouldn't impose the capital punishment because it doesn't deter There's no evidence that it is a deterrent. I don't know if it's a deterrent or not. Quite frankly, I'm not particularly interested if it's a deterrent or not. Because that's not the point. The point is not reformation or deterrence. The point is punishment. There are certain activities in human nature and society that actually deserve to be punished. And this is what Paul is talking about. For he is the minister of God, he says in verse 4, a revenger, an avenger, to execute wrath upon him that does evil. Now, Paul is using the same word here in verse number 4 in Romans chapter 13 that he's already used in chapter 12 at verse 19. You remember, we were considering it. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. We saw when we were looking at that passage that the Christian is absolutely forbidden to seek private vengeance. Does that mean to say that there is never going to be vengeance, and the word includes vindication of the innocent? Of course it doesn't mean that. We leave vengeance to God. But how does God execute vengeance upon the injustices that are perpetrated by the criminals of the world? He does so through the civil magistrate. What the private Christian is forbidden to do, the state is commanded to do, to take vengeance on behalf of the offended individuals, and on behalf of the victims of crime. Take vengeance for them on their behalf. They can't take vengeance for themselves. But the civil magistrate must take vengeance for them. This is what Paul is saying. For he is the minister for wrath. What wrath is this that Paul is speaking of? It's the wrath of God that Paul has in mind. Not the wrath of man. The wrath of man, as we're reading in James chapter 1, verse 20, the wrath of man does not work the righteousness of God. God doesn't entrust men to execute justice in their wrath, because we go too far. Someone will pluck out my eye. My tendency will be to pluck out both of his eyes. An eye for an eye. There's a limitation which is to be commensurate and limited to the extent of the crime. This is biblical justice, you see. And so what the Lord is saying to us here is that the civil magistrate, the legal system, is to be on the side of the criminalized, or those who have been offended against by the criminal, and to take vengeance and to execute God's wrath against that kind of misbehavior. A revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Now, just because you can impose the death penalty for certain crimes, and in the Old Testament there were actually 18 crimes for which you could be put to death. 18. But that does not mean to say that you must impose the death penalty. I'm not saying hang them high. We're not of those who say just because someone happens to kill someone that he must inevitably be killed himself. There may well be circumstances in which a measure of clemency would have to be allowed. And the death penalty must not in every single instance necessarily be imposed. See, the world's got this all wrong. I remember hearing the story of a very famous minister in Australia, in Victoria, down in Geelong actually. The debate of the death penalty was being aired publicly in the media and so on. And this good man was asked his opinion, did he approve of the death penalty? And he said, well, yes, under certain circumstances. And the reporter said, would you be willing to impose the death? He said, well, if I was called upon to as a servant of the state. The headlines the next day, and I got this from his son, minister wants to hang people. Minister wants to be a hangman. You see, the world has got this out of biblical focus. We are not hang them high, lynch mob. But we are those who believe that there are some crimes against man who bears the image of God, which are of such a degree of wickedness and maliciousness, that God's justice requires wrath in vengeance, and that may well be the ultimate taking of that life. This is what Paul is talking about here. And all of this is to be supported by Christian people as an act of devotion to God. A few comments. Time is gone, I know. And I'm not saying that this is the most evangelical sermon you'll ever hear, but we're seeking to expound the Word of God as it has a bearing on Christian living. How are Christian believers to respond to all of this? Just in a few words. Well, we have to recognize, first of all, this, that we are going to have to face the fact that there is no perfect government. There is always going to be a measure of injustice. We have to live with injustice. Justice ultimately will be done on the day of judgment. And then there will be perfect justice. In this world, the civil magistrate is always going to come short of the glory of God because he is like the rest of us. He is a fallen creature. And I, like you, I too have a sense of injustice because I was involved in a case many years ago, on the fringe of a case where, quite frankly, justice was not done. But we have to leave justice with God. And we have to live with the fact that in this world, there is going to be nothing that is perfectly ideal according to our Christian desires and standards. We have to live with reality. And the government might not be to our liking. And the verdicts in the courts may not be to our liking. But they are better than nothing. And the alternative very often would be nothing more than anarchy and mayhem. You've only to see that when tsunamis come, when tidal waves, when cities are, as it were, inundated with floods and with typhoons. And what do you find? You find the breaking down of law and order, and looting becomes the order of the day to such a degree that sometimes the National Guard has to be called out to use brute force to put it down. That's what happens when law and order is absent. There's another thing that the Christian believer must live with, and that is that he must never become over-attached to any particular political party. Now, I don't preach to you about politics. In fact, this is probably the first sermon in my 24 years that I've ever really spoken about this at all, as far as I remember. I don't remember speaking about this ever before. But the danger is, you see, that we will become so attached to a political worldview and a political party that we will, in fact, be unable to see the bigger picture that Paul is presenting before us here in Romans 13. God gives his sanction to no particular government. He gives his sanction to all governments. We quoted Hodge, government is from God. The form of government is from man. It used to be said in Queen Victoria's reign that the Tory party in England was the Church of England rather, was the Tory party at prayer. So allied was that political point of view that it was allied with Christianity or the prevailing state church of the day. And tragically, so allied with that particular political party was the national church of the day that it was against every other and indeed physically against other political parties. We must be careful. I've never been a member of a political party. I don't intend to be. I get invitations from time to time to go to Macquarie Street to meet with some of the dignitaries there. They have those prayer meetings. They have those, and there are political parties down there. And I get invitations. I get them quite regularly. And I've never attended one of them. Not because I want to be a hermit. Not because they're not doing good work. They are doing good work. But the danger is that when you become allied with that kind of political religious grouping, you're violating this. I joined none of them. I joined no society. When I came here at first, there were people of various groups, certain translations of the Bible, certain points of view concerning the Lord's Day, temperance. I joined none of them. Because the Bible doesn't encourage us to enter into that kind of party political standing. What does it mean to be a Christian? It means to live for Christ and seek to be holy and seek to serve Him despite all the imperfections and the injustices that surround us. To pray for the rulers, to testify for them, and to pay our taxes, to pay for the police force and the army and the navy which guards our shores. All of this, and indeed much more than this, is involved. This is what it means to be a Christian. For this cause, Paul says, you pay tribute to support the government of the day, which is God's appointed means to bring a measure of law and order into a society in which otherwise there would be anarchy and everybody would do what's right in his own eyes. God willing, we'll come back to this next time and look more fully at how we're to implement our subjection to the authorities given over us by God. May God bless His word to us.